Innovation Minds presents At the Edge, a podcast about using innovation to empower and drive engagement. The nature of work has changed. Companies around the world are struggling to find the right balance in the new work-from-home hybrid paradigm. As much of the workforce begins to go back to the office after more than a year working remotely, how can leaders keep their employees engaged and collaborating successfully? In this podcast, we interview thought leaders from business and hear their stories and viewpoints on how to use innovation to engage the workforce, as well as how to innovate engagement.
You know, every time in my experience that I've gone after engagement and done the work, it sort of magically appears earlier than you thought it would. So in the sourcing of data or in the conversation around the data, if the end goal is to create engagement, it unlocks slightly earlier. That's the music in the gaps between the notes that you learn to look out for when you've done this a couple of times. Because if you hit the drop exactly where it's supposed to be, and nobody can tell you whether it's 5 minutes and 30 seconds in, but there is a moment when it feels right. And if you drop the needle at that point in time, you'll get the outcomes that you're looking for. So I see the working towards engagement as engagement, and the outcome will be even more engagement. And if you continue to do work on it, it doesn't become engagement, it becomes embedded, and it actually then becomes cultural.
We're here today with Temba Chakela. He is the general manager of ways of working at Transnet, South Africa's state-owned transport company. He spent many years before that as the head of human resources at Dimension Data, and he describes himself on LinkedIn with more titles than almost anyone else I've seen. He is a change maven, an impact driver, a culture chemist, transformation trooper, organization whisperer, complexity slayer, value wrangler, and, most appropriate to us perhaps, an engagement engineer. Temba, welcome to Innovation at the Edge.
Thank you for being here. I'm really glad to have you. It's really a pleasure to have somebody here from South Africa.
Thanks, Michael. Happy to be here.
Now, you have an interesting background as a human resources expert. There's a long list on LinkedIn that we read earlier of the kind of titles you like for yourself. And the last one there is engagement engineer. So let's talk about engagement a little bit. And you know, what makes you an engagement engineer? And how do you get the workforce engaged?
I believe engagement needs to be intentional and approached with the same sense of respect and discipline that data engineering or chemical engineering would need. And that's really my take on engagement. You gotta work at it. I think a lot of us pay lip service to, you know, an engaged workforce is a productive one, or, you know, a happy worker is a productive worker. And I'm going, unless you really, really engage, so you go all in, as the millennials put it, in your 9-to-5, then you aren't truly engaged. And to prevent that from happening, You need to draw people in. I believe you need to be engaged from a head perspective. So the stuff you do needs to make sense to you. You need to be drawn in from a hand perspective. You need to be able to physically do your job. And then something that becomes really important when you have those two things buttoned down is your heart, and does what you do really align to your purpose. I'm also a data geek. So the first thing I do, and I guess it's a bit Covian as well, you need to understand before you make yourself understood. So I spend quite a lot of time asking questions that lead to insight. So a practical example, we had a team strategy session for one of our functions. And I got in, I know the head, the executives in that function say, you know, Temba, can you come and do something ways of workish? So what I did is a week before the session, I sent out three questions on a simple Microsoft form, Tell me the one thing you believe you should stop doing that's preventing, you know, clients that's negatively impacting client satisfaction. Give me the one thing you think you should start doing, and then give me the one thing you think you should continue doing. And we had a really productive conversation around what they can do as a team and establishing sort of full ownership of their engagement, because that's the other thing, right? We abdicate engagement to change management mystics and HR practitioners and think it'll go away. My approach is it's a full contact sport, and you draw in as many stakeholders as you can. So the executives that invited me in sort of came to me afterwards and said, if you told us it was going to be this much work, we might not have invited you, but you're lucky that it was this much fun. So we believe that, you know, it was time well spent. So that's just a practical example. You have to do it. It's a full contact sport. You learn a lot by doing it a lot of times, and you get to learn nuances and things you can and you cannot do. You know, every time in my experience that I've gone after engagement and done the work, it sort of magically appears earlier than you thought it would, because you're actually intervening with the system already. So in the sourcing of data or in the conversation around the data, if the end goal is to create engagement, it unlocks slightly earlier, and maybe that's the music in the gaps between the notes that you learn to look out for when you've done this a couple of times. Because if you hit, you know, it's like music. If you hit the drop exactly where it's supposed to be, and nobody can tell you whether it's 5 minutes and 30 seconds in, but there is a moment when it feels right. And if you drop the needle at that point in time, you will get the outcomes that you're looking for. So I see the working towards engagement as engagement, and the outcome will be even more engagement. And if you continue to do work on it, it doesn't become engagement, it becomes embedded, and it actually then becomes cultural. You have to keep at it. Engagement for me is not an event, and I think I've shared with you that I'm not a fan of these event surveys. You know, whether it's, you know, once a year you test how engaged the business is or how happy it is or whether you're the best employer on the planet. I'm much more of a pulse and nervous reaction time guy. So the closer you are to the heartbeat and life beat of your organization, which are your employees, you can do very creative things. You can run 30 surveys a month, as long as it's no longer than one question and the question is no longer than one line. And in the space, for example, that I have, is if you randomly send this out to 1,000 people, only after the 55th time do you run the risk of asking somebody the same question, assuming that it gets out to everyone. So for me, you always need to be asking that question: how are you doing? How are you doing? It's almost like a needy artist who constantly needs their work edified and looked at and commented on. The cool thing about working in this space is that your painting is never done. So it's a bit like painting in oils, and you can make adjustments as you go. And what might have been a starry night very quickly turns into a picture of the Milky Way by just a few smudges based on customer and employee feedback. You can't stop when you've got your engagement indicator up, because it is the thing that is telling you what your organization responds to positively, and those are the things that you should probably work on driving into the fiber of the organization. Get leadership to model it. You get your policies and procedures to work in line with it. You make sure that your comms and your engagements are built in that way. So if you follow the logic that if my purpose is to do good, and I'm working for an organization that does good, and our purposes align, and you know my colleagues are tolerable, and my manager is good, and my salary covers my covers the things that I need to pay for in terms of the basics. That's a powerful mixture for me being in that organization for a long time. It is when you have a deficit between person and org, when you have to start looking at all these other things to tweak them. But if I walk into the office every day and I'm aligned with our stated purpose, which is not just to move stuff around South Africa, but to positively influence every single citizen of the country, it doesn't matter what Michael offers me for his little for his startup that's going to generate millions over the next couple of years.
We talk about innovation at the edge. We talk about using innovation as an engagement technique. Have you experienced that? And tell us about that if you have.
So one of the things we explored when I was in the smaller of my consulting companies was getting everybody's voice heard, but also bringing the bulk of the business into our confidence. And one of the things we spoke about is a traditionally, I'll say, South African or Southern African. It resounds across the continent and maybe across the globe. But the meeting of elders in a village happens right next to where you keep your cattle, and they would always have those important conversations. But often they would insist that the next crop of men and maybe next crop of adolescents are sitting two or three rings out, so that they hear why is Michael and Temba debating deep issues and resolving anything from cattle theft to the well running dry for the entire village. And what that does is it not only it brings your communities closer together, but it also allows everybody to hear the realities on the ground. And very little is taboo in those conversations, but the only people that speak in that forum are the people in the inner circle. Then what usually happens is Mike walks home with his son, and his son asks questions about what happened there, and you clear those up. And the next time your son and my son meet, they have a conversation about what they heard. And so you industrialize your learning and actually pass on orally some of these things. So that's pretty much how I try to use Microsoft Teams. So I'm famous for having inviting people to my meeting, and then they would be the core invitees to discuss an issue. And then what I'll try and do is also invite some fringe beneficiaries who I think might benefit from hearing what we're talking about. And I've seen some green shoots of that spreading. I guess the only challenge with us is that we're not sitting on a quiet evening after the plow has been drawn up and the cattle have been corralled. We're in a fairly rapid moving workspace, and time is at maybe a greater premium than you'd have in those sessions. But that for me is, again, how do you take a platform that has become fairly commoditized, especially in the last year, and everybody thinks they know how to use Teams and they're using it properly. There's applications of it that can be used to maybe even mitigate some of the human connection challenges that we see. And I'm a high touch guy. In my previous role, the word on the street was, if you're looking for Temba, look for him anywhere but his office, because I'd work in 45 minute sprints. So I'd be at my laptop for 45 minutes, then I'd literally get up and walk somewhere and connect with a grad, or walk into somebody's office who are struggling with something, or just go to the balcony, sit on the balcony and enjoy the view. I think I read last week about a company in the States that took a radical position. They sent out a memo, because I guess their labor law is slightly different to ours, saying, we no longer have full-time employees in this organization. You're either employed 20% of your time, 40% of your time, or 60% of your time. Please indicate on the form below, and your salary and everything else will magically be updated in the background by the HR Oompa Loompas. And what they did with their office sites is that they shut down, I think, half of them and then refurbished the other half of them to only do two things. You could only find collaborative space, so big whiteboards and smart surfaces and all of that stuff, and foosball machines, pinball machines, table tennis, pool tables, and popcorn machines and cotton candy machines, because they made the decision that the only thing that's going to happen at the office from this point onwards is collaboration and team building. And that's what they did. And you know, I think there was a brilliant HR person behind that decision. Can you imagine if we were able to think of the office as a place of fun and where I meet my friends to collaborate? What that would do to you in the morning? I mean, I can hear Eye of the Tiger playing already, right? And I look at my 8-year-old, 9-year-old. He sees school that way. Having to learn stuff, and luckily it comes fairly easily to him. But his reason for going to school is to see Luke, Gareth, Kyle, and Naba. The fact that he has to listen to Mrs. Groenewald talk to them about, you know, take them through Afrikaans spelling bees is a byproduct and well worth it, because he gets to see his friends daily. Now, I want that same kind of excitement. You know, can you imagine turning that excitement around and leveraging that in the workplace?
You know, he's not going to school to learn.
No.
but learning becomes the conduit to his getting engaged, in a sense, right? Like, he's able to get that engagement because he has to go to school to learn. So it's in the same way. Is it possible to look at work as a situation like that, where the activities of work are actually something which ends up with an engaged workforce, rather than it being, you know, your first step, but rather like you're working towards that because you know that all the things along the way are also productive?
In my interview for this role, I was asked, so, you know, Temba, when are you at your best? And I said, you know, I'm at my best when I'm shoulder to shoulder, shield to shield, and spear to spear with people equally driven, equally skilled, and equally caring about each other as I am, with a good general, you know, telling us when to point and thrust. And the best times of my life at the workplace was when we had really, really difficult issues to deal with, but you had shoulder to shoulder, shield to shield, spear to spear, and we were all pointing these things in one direction and getting things solved. That's when you forget that it's Friday evening, or somebody says, you know, come in, we need to solve this thing on Saturday, and you say yes before you've spoken to your wife and kids. That's when you're all in. And for me, creating that magic also needs to be intentional, right? Because if your capacity outstrips your capability, you just have a lot of people that aren't necessarily focused. If it's the other way around, you have too few people, and you're not enough hands. If you don't have or demand great leadership and management, you don't get the kind of progress that you need. And all of these things daisy chain, at least in my experience, to create, you know, that feeling of flow when you lose time at work.
Is there a special African element to any of this? I mean, do you think that in your experience, there's something Africa can offer the rest of the world in terms of ways of working, in terms of ways of engaging, in terms of innovation?
One of our public sector businesses that used to be a real shining beacon for what it did and what it delivered has now gone into clear distress. And we didn't bemoan the revenue. We bemoaned the fact that the innovation that was coming out of that business had so many parallels. And there seems to be something in, I don't know whether it's the African sun or the African soil, that drives this curiosity to solve stuff. I mean, you may be familiar with the two young gentlemen that have built an electronic truck or bucky, as we call them, in South Africa. with limited resources and limited schooling. We've all watched the Netflix flick about the boy that harnessed the wind to create a dynamo and to power things. So I think there is something. I'd like to take a broader perspective and say that it is in our DNA as human beings. It's what helped us step out of the caves. And I always say to people that my one of my biggest heroes is the first person that looked at a hen and said, "I'm going to eat the next thing that comes out from that animal," and then proceeded to do so, because there is a bravery in being first through the door. So yeah, I would say definitely our environment, and maybe it's the context of perpetual scarcity that we face, whether it's electricity, water, all of these things that creates innovation that may not necessarily jump to the forefront in a country like Sweden, where I don't think there's very many people with a living memory of a power outage in that country.
Yeah, you talk quite a bit about the use of AI in human resources.
Practical example: somebody called me this morning. They have 700 CVs to read through to get to a shortlist. And my immediate answer was, there has to be a better way. And then my second answer was, wait, I know of a better way. Could you not run it through this kind of bot or algorithm and make your life a little bit more fun than reading through 700 documents? But I believe that there are distinct jobs that the human brain has no place doing or shouldn't need to do in a world where you can automate. The HR practitioner that phoned me with these 700 CVs could probably spend their time truly business partnering with her clients in those hours she would have spent reading through CVs. I see bots and AI like colleagues. And if we take that approach to robotics and AI, you can then really, really begin to open up the spaces for true human, right, which is what the H in HR stands for. And it's often said very quickly, and you move straight to resources. But for me, it's about trying to get back to that human interaction and human interface, even if it's fed by insights and actionable intelligence that comes from artificial intelligence or bots.
So if you had to share with the world, Temba, your experience as a human resources expert, here you are speaking to the world listening to this podcast. What would you want to share with them that's uniquely your vision or your learning that you'd want people to make sure that they take away from this?
I think any solution tabled for anything is incomplete without a people lens applied. And this goes for, I guess, solving world peace to world hunger, to developing the next set of VR goggles for use in the built environment. And we need to place a premium and some respect on that lens, because I think it's become undervalued over time. And for the last at least 200 years, there's been this emphasis on technological advancements, and maybe not to the detriment, but the people side has maybe been pushed back. I mean, if you look at the way factories were laid out in the first industrial revolution, and then you look at how classrooms were laid out, it became very clear that classrooms, the kids are sitting two by two at a desk. Guess what? They're going to be putting together widgets two by two at a desk. But that evolution that we've seen in industry has not necessarily been mirrored in the way we approach education, for example. So my kids still sit two by two at a desk, but the one wants to become a gamer and the other one is on his way to become a world-renowned pop icon if he gets it right. And I'll help him as much as I can. But for me, that would be my perspective. So you ask me any question, my first answer is people. And then I'll sort of figure out why my answer was people to the question. And we've heard, especially in this part of the world, the narrative has been around the fourth industrial revolution. I can't wait for the fifth, and people are beginning to talk about it. And it's where tech meets the hardware meets the wetware that sits between our ears. And if we don't have an understanding about how the brain works and neuro-linguistic planning and those things that are considered as mystical to engineers as we see wind resistance as people practitioners in their field, those two things are going to become really important. And I suspect that the people that are going to be successful in the future world of work are those that understand the intersection and optimize it to their benefit. And you can't do that without without the understanding. So whether you call it, you know, ways of working or how I introduce myself at barbecues, because I don't want to say I'm in HR, I'm just a people guy. And that's the perspective I will always have. And I think the more people that can either oscillate between that lens and another or multiple lenses, those are the people that are going to drive the next wave of innovation. You can't just be a technologist anymore. You can't just be an HR manager anymore. You have to find a way to live somewhere in between.
HR is about innovation and innovation is about people.
I mean, human resource management, and I get the chills just saying that, right? Because it's already impersonal. In my change management journey, at some point I started saying, look, I grew up herding cows and I know what that's like. And you manage cows, but you know, we should probably call it change engagement management, because human beings, as soon as you try and manage them, they're going to go everywhere but where you want them to go. And if you draw them in early and get them to engage and believe in where in the destination, the journey becomes fun and easier. So I think they're intertwined. I think you may see HR definition or scope shrink in a way in I guess the opposite response to how it's become really broad over time to mean those specific tactical and transactional items that drive human resource management service delivery. And then you'll have all these other portfolios sitting next to it. So that's for example, how we're set up at the moment. We have talent management, employee relations, ways of working, health and wellness. And then we have service delivery. And service delivery, if you look down a level, is where you find traditional, and then I mean that respectfully because it is important, traditional HR as you'd expect to find it. But it is influenced and peppered by all these other portfolios where we have the freedom to unabashedly look at what we think is the best way to drive culture in Transnet.
Anything else that you'd like to add before we close?
People are critical. I think that's that would be my biggest message. The people discipline needs guidance and a firm hand as everything else. And the more we have people working in this space and that diversity of experience, the better we'll be. So I am a firm believer of blinkers off, hand up, and mouth open. So my opinions are readily available, and I wear them on my sleeve, and I interact with people who do the same. Does that fit?
You guys heard it. Temba, his mouth is open and his ears are open, so reach out to him. You'll be able to find him here, also on LinkedIn. And he is the world's top change maven, driver, culture chemist, transformation trooper, transformation club, flexibility slayer, value wrangler, engagement engineer, all in one.
I'm going to whittle that down. It is long. I had a lot of fun putting it together, but it's long.
It's fun. So anyway, Temba, thank you very much for being here and giving your time to us.
Mike, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it. And good luck with the rest.
This has been At the Edge, a podcast from Innovation Minds. We look forward to hosting you on our next episode, which you can find through the same channel you got here with today. Please join our LinkedIn group where you can discuss every episode. You can find the link in the show notes. We're really glad you were here, and thank you very much from Innovation Minds.